It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with UW-Milwaukee Director of Athletics, Amanda Braun, who is being recognized for academic, athletic, and fundraising successes over a decade. As we discuss the operations of college athletics, call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Amanda Braun started leading Panther Athletics in 2013. Amanda, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. The Women Leaders in College Sports organization, which you are so active in, recently recognized you as Executive of the Year. You're a trailblazer at UW-Milwaukee. What does this recognition mean to you?
Yeah, you're right, Kate. It is an organization that has been really important to me throughout my career, just in terms of the way they support women and work to advance them in our industry. So it means a great deal because of that. There's a really dynamic CEO there who just has the right approach to getting this done, collaborating across all kinds of organizations with male leaders and colleagues in our business. And it was a nomination that came from a friend, a colleague, a group of friends. So that makes it even more special.
The Women Leaders in College Sports says women account for fewer than one in every four athletic directors in the NCAA. How could college sports become a more welcoming, inclusive workplace for women in leadership roles?
Yeah, you know, that's the question I think we're working to answer, and not just for women, but for people of color as well. You know, how do we create a pipeline that that welcomes folks, no matter what their background, and appreciate the difference and diversity that folks bring? So I think the question really is answered by encouraging people to do that early on, right? And for me, that's part of my why. I certainly enjoy being a leader. I'm a strategic thinker, problem solver, all those things that come with organizational leadership. But also, I care a lot about making sure that women see other women in these roles. And so I work hard to encourage not just our women, but our male colleagues also within our department and our league to see women as leaders. And so it's a hand-to-hand, day-to-day thing, really. There isn't one answer, but that's certainly a part of my work.
It seems as if mentorship and collaboration is really important in this organization. And I just wonder, is a membership organization for women leaders in college sports, is that needed for these women administrators long into the future? Will there be a day when a specific organization is not needed?
Yeah, I hope so. I really do, though. I think there will always be some uniqueness to our experiences, you know, and often only other women can appreciate the subtleties that we experience as leaders in any organization, right, in any industry. And so I think that will always be helpful to share perspective and support one another in those ways. But yeah, certainly I hope we advance where, you know, 50% of athletics directors at all levels of college athletics are women. That would be terrific.
So what are those leadership subtleties on the business side, that differentiate women in collegiate sports, administration?
Well, I wouldn't say it's a whole lot different from leadership for women generally. You know, the socialized expectations for how we look or behave, or, you know, we're walking a tightrope often, right? Mm-hmm. Are you too ambitious or too, use the word aggressive, or, you know, are you too much of a pushover? And those, that's just one example, you know, the approach to your work and your communication style. I've always thought a sense of humor is really important when I have, those experiences. I often just take it with a grain of salt, try to laugh at it. Obviously, if there's a real issue, you have to respond to it right on. But often it's the subtleties. It's people not understanding. I can't tell you the number of times in my 10 years here at UWM, people have said, so you're the athletic director for all of the sports? And my guess is men don't get that question. And I And I don't react to anything but grace. Like, yeah, in fact, yes. And we have 15 sport programs,
All
300
15
student
of
athletes.
them, in fact.
Yeah, right. Yep.
We're talking about college sports with UW-Milwaukee's Director of Athletics, Amanda Braun, with us. You can join in with your questions and comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. You played basketball for Siena College in New York. Also, you're on the NCAA Women's Basketball Committee. What challenges are facing women's basketball?
Well, a lot of that has become public, in the last couple of years with the splash in the NCAA tournament. I think that was in 2021. It was just as I was joining the committee, just before, and there was a gender equity review and report created that landed with our committee in several of the action items. So, it's things that have been there for a long, long time that are now, I think, becoming more public, which, obviously discomfort breeds change. And it's not comfortable to see that women are maybe being treated differently, at least for many of us. And so I think, that there are those challenges of equity, of opportunity, the quality of experiences that women have. And, I'm on the side on our committee and in our conversations that, men's basketball, the popularity and the multimedia rights agreements and those things, those happened over time and happened organically, right? People got interested in the sport and started to tune in and show up. And so we're starting to see some of that too on the other side of rather than just the gender equity report and our actions, but people are really getting excited about women's basketball and women's sports in general, which is wonderful. And there's a chicken egg thing there, right? Does media exposure create that, or do you have to be really entertaining and fun to watch and quality in order for the media to show up? But I think it's a confluence of those things are starting to happen together, which is great. And so while there's challenges, I think we're starting to see some real progress, and that's exciting.
Are athletic directors doing enough to push giving sports like women's basketball or women's volleyball, soccer, more visibility, more coverage, more resources?
I think so. We all, and it depends, right? We're at the Division I level, and our resources are a bit larger than in Division II and certainly in Division III, even without football. And so we really have to be focused on ensuring that we're funding our programs appropriately. And that's not just the men's programs, that's the women's as well. In many of our departments, the road right now for revenue generation does run through often male sports. So we'd love to diversify that more. And the marketing efforts are there for women's sports. I certainly know that in our department, we care a great deal about all of our sport programs. We have a lot of success in our women's sports, volleyball, soccer, swimming, diving, track and field. So we do put the attention there. We've got to get folks to cover us a little bit more, get some more, media exposure that we're not necessarily creating ourselves, that folks show up and show some interest and then take full advantage of that when that happens.
In terms of name, image, likeness, U.S. Supreme Court ruling clearing the way for student athletes to receive that compensation, but a minority of athletes actually receive this compensation. How beneficial are NIL rights to athletes?
Well, having the opportunity is really beneficial, and I think is really, really positive. And right now, two markets have been created. They're true NIL, where, as you suggest, not every student athlete is going to, make 5-6 figures annually on their name, image, and likeness because their profile doesn't dictate that. But that's true in professional sports and in all walks of life. What's really cool about it is student athletes can go back to their hometown in the summer or whenever and do camps and clinics utilizing their name, their image, and perhaps make some money there, just as though they were working a job. The second market that's being created right now is a pay for play that has everyone concerned, that student athletes aren't really doing the work to earn those. It's not really about their, what would be dictated out in the market around their name, image, and likeness. It's really more about trying to get them to attend a school, and I'm talking mostly about football and to a large degree men's basketball, particularly at the top 50 or so programs.
UW-Milwaukee Athletics Director Amanda Braun with us on the work of administering an NCAA Division I athletics program. You can be part of the discussion along the way. Call in with a question, add comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. UW-Milwaukee is home to 15 NCAA Division I teams. We have its Director of Athletics, Amanda Braun, recognized as Executive of the Year by the organization Women Leaders in College Sports. Call in with a question, share your perspective, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Amanda, last month, the state legislature advances a Republican-backed measure that would limit college athletes to playing on teams depending on the gender they were assigned at birth. And if the measure passes the full legislature, Governor Tony Evers has vowed to block the plan from becoming law. How are you addressing this proposal with staff and athletes?
Yeah, this issue has been around for quite some time, and we have had a number of conversations, not just with our coaches. I had a roundtable last year with our head coaches just to hear from them on this topic and are they having experiences in recruiting and that sort of thing. And so it was very interesting to hear their perspective. And interestingly, they hadn't bumped into it a whole lot. And in fact, one of our coaches said, well, this has been, we've had transgender athletes in our sport for, you know, decades, you know, and now it's becoming an issue, which I understand, having been a former student athlete myself. I can understand that perspective and the difficulty that folks have with transgender women participating in women's sports. I do understand that. I do feel like if we can come together and have conversations as opposed to being so oppositional on the issue. Unfortunately, that is what's happening right now. There isn't an easy answer, in my opinion. But it's something that's worth analysis, worth conversation, and really trying to find a solution.
Is it worth conversation in the legislative environment in state law?
Yeah, you know, I can't really speak to that. Okay. I understand why people are putting it there. I do. You know, that's where folks go is to try to get something done at that level. I'm not sure that's necessary, but it's advanced to that. So I'll be interested to see how it evolves. I you know, we are very, very open with our student athletes about caring for all of who they are and ensuring that they feel safe and included in our athletic department. But that's a sticky issue.
Caring for them. What is UW-Milwaukee doing to establish a welcoming environment for athletes of diverse backgrounds?
Yeah, you know, I'm glad you asked that. We're really proud of the work that we've done around diversity, equity, and inclusion within our athletic department. And it's been longstanding. We've worked with our athletic board, who are folks on campus, faculty, staff, to create diversity and equity and inclusion statement, to put out on our website a resource page for current student athletes, prospective staff and student athletes that includes a lot of resources that they can go to. We've engaged with third parties to come in and do some sessions to facilitate conversations around those issues. And it's just, I think, a really healthy environment. And, you know, you always hope that that's how it is. Yesterday, I spent some time with some of our staff in the morning who've been here a year or less to get some feedback from them and hear how we're doing. And one of our new coaches made a comment. He said, "I just can't believe the resources that you have here. Where I came from, we didn't have that. Our student athletes are so well supported. And mental health resources, we take that very seriously and have advanced that quite a bit. It's one of our priorities annually." So yeah, we care a lot. We're fortunate that our UVP really is a personalized experience. We have a little over 300 student athletes, and we're all located really in one building. So that's what I love about my job. I get to walk down the hallway and see student athletes, coaches, and staff every minute of every day. It's fantastic.
Amanda Braun, UW-Milwaukee's Director of Athletics. As we talk about the business of administrating college sports, you can join in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Paul in Summit is here. Paul, hi.
Hi, great program. Thank you, Amanda, for your generosity this morning. I'm an educator and I've seen the benefits of diversity, equity, and inclusion. I wanted to know what you're doing to support student athletes academically. And thanks for the program.
Paul, thank you for the question. Amanda, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. Well, that's one of our points of pride. So I'm really glad that Paul asked about that. Gosh, it's I think 23 years, 46 semesters, as was noted in the intro, of a 3.0 or better by our 300 student athletes. And so we it starts with recruiting. You know, our coaches are really interested in students that want to attain a meaningful degree and move on in life. And if they can continue to play their sport, great for a little while. But as people say, the ball stops bouncing eventually. So it starts with our coaches and who they select to bring in. We have a great infrastructure within our department. We've got three folks full time who support our student athletes academically and ensure that they're in the right classes and that they're getting the right support from tutors on campus or whatever that is. And then our university within each school and college has wonderful advisors who advise our student athletes on that side of things as well. So it takes a team, and that is the reason why we do what we do, right? Is to provide a great experience for our student athletes and a meaningful education.
In order to create that foundation and that support, though, of course, you have to have the resources, the staffing for that. We're seeing at UW Green Bay, UW Oshkosh, other campuses in the Universities of Wisconsin system, administrators are facing budget pressures and laying off staff. Are athletic departments managing similar financial headwinds?
We sure are. Yes, we are fully integrated into the university, at Milwaukee. We're not generating a whole lot of revenue that at all over and above what we spend. So we're fully integrated to the university and are dealing with the same types of challenges. So it has not been easy over the last few years, but academic support is one area where we definitely don't want to compromise. And so we will find other ways. We're fortunate that we have a wonderful donor base who have helped us get some things done. Would love to do more investment, would love to grow a bit more with things, but right now it's really been about maintaining the quality of experience that we came for our student athletes.
You facilitated this large expansion of the Clatchy Annex, its expansion serving a primary practice facility for basketball teams. Does the athletic department have ambitions to improve other facilities?
Well, we sure do. Just like everything, you have your dreams, you have your plans, you want to be ready when the opportunities present themselves. At Milwaukee, at UWM, we're in this really cool part of the city, in the Upper East Side, in a great neighborhood up there. We're a bit landlocked. So, like the rest of our campus, when it comes to facilities, there's not a whole lot that we can do expansion-wise. So, we've been fortunate to partner with Rock Ventures for our baseball stadium in the Wisconsin Center District for Panther Arena in order to provide what we need for our student athletes. So, we're constantly tweaking and improving, doing some refurbishing and renovation of our current facilities. That expansion was great. It was really just a parking lot that we were able to utilize right across from our main building. It's only about 16,000 square feet, but we maximized every inch of it to create a great facility.
We only have a few moments left, but why should athletes consider playing for the Panthers when the Badgers offer a bigger national profile?
Yeah, I always say, Kate, that there's only so many opportunities, minutes in certain sports, opportunities to be a point scorer in track and field and swimming and diving. So student athletes need to make a decision where they can have that experience if they want to be at a high level wherever they are. So we offer a great opportunity for that. And then we're a really personalized experience. We get to know our student athletes and we ensure that they're successful.
Amanda, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kate. It's been wonderful talking with you this morning.
Amanda Braun is Director of Athletics at UW-Milwaukee. She has led Panther Athletics since 2013. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Department of Natural Resources publishes preliminary numbers on the recent gun deer season. We dig into the findings from this harvest. But first, utilities say a proposed power plant in Superior will cut carbon emissions by burning natural gas. Plant owners say the step is needed as utilities shift away from coal. To environmentalists, building more fossil fuel plants feels like a step backward. Danielle Kading reports a federal agency will soon release its findings on the plant's environmental effects.
Coal-burning power plants are bad for climate change. That's because burning coal releases a lot of carbon dioxide that contributes to global warming. Renewable energies like wind and solar are much cleaner, and they don't rely on fossil fuels. But the utilities say those energy sources just aren't reliable enough to provide power at all times, and battery technology isn't far along enough to make it through Wisconsin winters. That's why John Carr says power plants that run on natural gas are an important part of the transition to clean energy.
When wind and solar aren't quite enough to meet demand, it's there to ensure that that system is still reliable and affordable.
Carr is vice president for strategic growth at the La Crosse-based Dairyland Power Cooperative. Dairyland is part of a group of utilities in three states that's trying to build a new $700 million energy plant in Superior that would run on natural gas. They've been trying to build the Nemadji Trail Energy Center for 6 years. For many environmentalists, though, any new plant that still relies on fossil fuels isn't part of a clean energy transition. Jadine Sonada is the campaign coordinator for Sierra Club Wisconsin.
We need to be only investing in this clean energy and not simultaneously investing in the gas plant.
That disagreement is part of what has kept the Nemadji Trail project in limbo for so long. Dairyland has asked for a loan from the Federal Rural Utilities Service to pay for half the project's cost. That triggered an environmental analysis of the plant. The proposal has undergone multiple reviews as environmental and indigenous groups have fought it. Now a decision is drawing near. The Rural Utilities Service will decide whether building the plant will have significant environmental effects. One September evening, a small group is buzzing about the facility in a corner room of Superior's public library.
My main concern about that is that it would still generate fossil fuels.
That's Superior resident Kate Haga. The 23-year-old is worried about its effects on climate change. She points out natural gas production releases methane that has more than 80 times the warming power of carbon dioxide.
It's going to just speed up climate change rather than do what it's marketed to be, which is to be this bridge where we're addressing climate change.
Even with methane leaks, the Rural Utilities Service said in its latest review that the plant would cut carbon emissions overall each year by 770,000 tons compared to keeping coal plants online. But environmental groups argue the plant's carbon emissions are at least a million tons higher than the agency projected. And the Environmental Protection Agency says estimates of climate damages from the project don't look right either. Most everyone agrees that closing coal plants is a good thing. The debate is over what takes their place.
The natural gas plants are being built in part because of the rapid ramp down in coal-fired plants.
That's Karen Clay. She's a professor of economics and public policy at Carnegie Mellon University. If a plant isn't built, Clay says it may be more costly to bring in natural gas from elsewhere or maintain older coal plants. Minnesota Power has closed 7 of its 9 coal plants, and Dairyland closed one of its coal plants in southwestern Wisconsin 2 years ago. Utilities say the Superior facility will help Wisconsin meet its goal of providing carbon-free electricity by 2050. But UW-Madison energy expert Greg Nemeth says any new plants would release carbon dioxide beyond that date, or they'd have to shut down early.
We're going to be saddled with a lot of debt, and ratepayers are going to have to pay a lot for all these natural gas plants that we don't use anymore.
Now, some city leaders are withdrawing their support for the plant. They're concerned about its environmental effects, as well as more local concerns. It would be built along the banks of the Nemadji River, and it's next to a cemetery with remains of tribal ancestors that were moved there to make way for a development that was never built. Some city council members say they'll oppose local permits for the project. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Department of Natural Resources issues a preliminary report on the recently concluded gun deer season. We get takeaways from the 9-day harvest and how it compares to years past. You can be part of this discussion on deer hunting. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jeff Pritzel is here, deer program specialist at the DNR. Jeff, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate. It's great to be back with you.
Jumping right into the numbers, the gun deer harvest down by nearly 18% from last year. And one of your working theories for the drop involves how hunters store meat in freezers. What do you think is happening?
Well, yeah, and that is just one theory. And one of the things we all do with deer hunting, just as we do with other things we're really interested in or passionate about, is we like to analyze and speculate and try to find answers as to why things change or why things go up or down. And one of the things we've seen in the last 4 years is this kind of a fluctuation in antlerless deer harvest. And so that's the bigger changes we've seen are really driven by the antlerless deer harvest going up or down. The buck harvest tends to be a little steadier. And we've seen this swing in 2020, the first year of COVID. There was a lot of activity. A lot of people were out hunting. Some issues with meat processing plants and access to meat. There was more incentive to maybe put some venison in the freezer. And we saw that play out in 2020. And then that was followed by a pretty good big drop in 21, which was kind of concerning, especially in the farmland part of the state where we really rely on that antlerless harvest to try to, you know, manage deer population growth. Then it swung back up in 2022, which was nice to see that rebound. And now this year it dropped off again. And so it gets me thinking about, you know, that incentive to harvest an antlerless deer. Is there carryover venison in the freezer from last year? And then is there that drive or initiative? And then the following year, the freezer's empty. It's time to fill it up again.
Yeah, very, very practical approach there. How long can venison keep in the freezer, by the way?
Well, you really want to use it within a year.
Okay.
And as things go with some folks that have chest freezers, an old colleague of mine, a good hunting friend, sometimes would joke that he'd find venison in his bottom of the freezer that was old enough to go to kindergarten.
And no.
That's not a good thing. But you can convert that into ground meat or something like that and certainly still make use of it. But ideally, we want to use it faster. And part of that equation is sharing venison with friends and family that may not hunt themselves.
Much of northern and central Wisconsin is experiencing dry or drought conditions. How might the weather affect deer harvests?
Well, that dry condition, usually in Wisconsin, drought isn't a big deal because we're pretty water plentiful relative to some of the western states where a drought can really impact fawn survival, for example. But I have talked with some of my colleagues in the northern part of the state where vegetation quality is really important to the does when they are lactating and nursing their fawns. And there may have been some, downturn in terms of nutrition that was available in the vegetation this year that might have played a role. But That's usually not a primary driver in Wisconsin. It's usually, especially for northern Wisconsin, it's the winter and how many deer can the landscape carry through the late winter months.
Looking at CWD, the DNR analyzed over 17,000 deer samples for chronic wasting disease last year, found nearly 1,500 positive cases. When does the DNR expect to know this year's numbers?
Yeah, that'll be a little while, yet we are basically right in the middle of the bulk of getting, having gotten all the samples in, really peaks during the gun deer season, of course. Mm-hmm. And we're probably just getting over, we're more than halfway through, but the folks are going to be really busy through next week yet. And so then analyzing that and packaging it in a way that helps represent what's happening, county by county, that takes a little bit of time. So it's usually actually January before we really can provide a preliminary report. And our CWD monitoring calendar year actually goes, I believe it's March to March or April to April. So it's April really of every year before we can produce a final, kind of a picture for what happened over the previous year.
So what would a hunter do if they have a positive CWD test on a deer they harvest?
Well, so what the department does is we're essentially providing a public service for those hunters that want to make that informed decision, to find out, if that animal is, test positive. And then it's really a personal choice based on the information that's available. The recommendation from, state agencies and national agencies is that if the animal does test positive, not to consume that animal. And unfortunately, the safest thing to do is to get that meat into the landfill stream and not consume it. But we also, part of that is, that's part of the monitoring, is just the general awareness that, so people understand which part of the states have the highest prevalence of the disease, because one of the things we can do to mitigate the continued expansion of the disease is make sure that all hunters, that are successful, harvested deer. One of the first things that we do is butcher the deer. And then what do you do with the remains, that are not going to be consumed? And it's important that those go into a safe disposal, scenario. And so we provide landfills and strategies for getting all remains from butchered deer, into the landfill system. And part of that over the last number of years has been this growth in providing dumpsters across the state for people to bring the carcass remains to, so that we make sure that they do get into the landfill system.
Should all hunters have their deer tested for chronic wasting disease?
So all hunters would mean, a 250,000 deer being tested in the state, and there simply isn't the capacity to handle that. Through the testing labs and that type of thing. We have an annual goal of trying to get upwards of, 19,000-20,000 tests through the system. And, we're, like I said, last year we were just over 17,000, and we hope to do that again this year. Given that the harvest numbers are trending down this year, that probably means that'll impact our total sample size as well.
Jeff Pritzel, Deer Program Specialist at the Department of Natural Resources, discussing the recently ended gun deer season. Be part of the conversation along the way. Call in with a question. Share your perspective. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Department of Natural Resources publishes preliminary figures for harvest totals and license sales in the gun deer hunt season. And the hunt started Saturday before Thanksgiving. It ended Sunday. Jeff Pritzel is the DNR's deer program specialist, and you can add your thoughts to the discussion. Call in with a question, share your views, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Jeff in Delafield. Jeff, hi. What would you like to ask?
Yes, good morning. My question is in relation to the sense and the attractants that people can buy, hunters can buy at sporting goods stores. Is there a danger of those scents and whatnot that people, you know, spray or, you know, put out by their tree stands or whatever, actually spreading chronic wasting disease? Thank you.
Thank you. Jeff Pritzel.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. That's a great question. And that's been debated really across the country. And you see that rule or how that's treated differently in some states. And it really comes down to a matter of overall risk tolerance and mitigation, and to what level do you want to say, all right, we're not going to do this because, you know, we're going to go to that level of prevention. And there's a number of things we do in Wisconsin. Eliminating or preventing the use of the liquid scents or attractants is not one of those. You know, the reason it comes up as a question is that the source of that product is from captive deer in the captive deer industry, and both the captive deer industry and the wild deer management of their natural resources are battling with their own issues of chronic wasting disease. So the awareness of it being in the captive deer industry, you know, connects it to is that a source. And so of all the ways that a deer has and sheds prions and whatnot, and there's ways to make sure that product are coming from, you know, disease-free facilities and those types of things. And so steps are taken. In the end, that the use of baits and attractants is part of the public input process through rules and laws and legislation. And right now in Wisconsin, you know, that product is still, you know, viable to be used in the state.
Let's turn to the preliminary figures. Once again, the northern forest region seeing a 30% drop in total deer harvest this season compared to last year. No other hunting region lost more than 20% of its harvest compared to last year. Why is the Northwoods seeing a steeper decline than other regions?
So if we look at the state as a whole this year in general, and this started not just with the gun deer season, but with the beginning of the archery season, there's this general trend in the state that as you move west and north, the harvest kind of fell off a little more relative to last year. And the northern forest simply is a little more unstable and variable in terms of annual harvest. They're more sensitive to the winter effects. We did have a severe winter last year. That really affected more the northwest counties, and that's why, again, we saw that in the harvest. But there's just other things that we see more variability in the north. And so we saw a pretty good swing upward last year. And so this year we have the opposite effect. And when you compare it to just the previous year, that's why you get these bigger swings and percent changes. When we look at the five-year average, we're still below the five-year average, but we're not as far off, and we're on the low end of the five-year average, whereas last year we were on the high end of the five-year average. And so that kind of creates that space or that gap. That's kind of where we're what we're seeing. We're still we're not outside of the norm. This harvest season is playing out very much like 2019 did. And the following year, we had a pretty good uptick in 2020.
Do those swings, though, affect the larger ecosystem in which the deer live?
Yeah, well, they can. And in the north, especially, there's just that stronger connection. But that annual fluctuation, here's another thing historically. We look at the deer harvest and we look at changes in the harvest, and we connect that and we want to presume that it's directly tied to a change in the deer population. Mm. And that used to be the case. I'd say prior to the turn of the century, we really treated the harvest as a direct barometer of what the deer population was doing. In the last couple of decades, for a host of reasons, that connection is kind of separated somewhat. It's still there, but it's not as strongly connected. So we see these annual fluctuations in harvest now that are a little bit more driven by the conditions of the year and other things. It's not just that the population itself went up and down, but we track the population through the harvest every year. And what we'll do now when this harvest season is done is we'll use this harvest data to back calculate, to estimate how many deer must have been alive back in September before all the hunting season started. And that's where we'll capture if there was a real change in deer population and measure how much of an effect did that winter have last year up in the Northwest.
Jeff Pritzel, DNR Deer Program Specialist, tracking these figures on the recent gun deer hunt. You can join in 800-642-1234 with your question. Tom in Columbus has one. Tom, hi. Hi, Tom. Can you hear us?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Maybe.
Hello.
Hi. Yes. Go ahead, Tom.
Am, yeah.
Yes.
Hi. I'm wondering if, you know, and thanks again for your guest. My son and I both had successful hunts. That was terrific. And the first time I've gotten him out there in a number of years. So personally, the season was set before we even squeezed the trigger. Just having him along and being out there with him was the reward. But I'm wondering if, you know, non-registration in person, you know, non-registration has maybe dinged our harvest rate just a little bit. We know people that don't register anymore. They don't buy license anymore. Their parcels of land are set back off the road, and they don't even bother anymore. Now, again, my wife and I love the outdoors way too much to jeopardize losing our privileges of any kind over you know, a deer. But we know people that don't report anymore. And I mean, the non-registration where people would swap their stories and you know, at the registration stations and the traditions. That
community. Yeah. Tom, I'm going to jump in here, Jeff, because we have less than a minute left. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. And first, that attitude that Tom is sharing is awesome. And that's really what it's all about. And to do this as quickly as possible, I would say that for the history of deer hunting, just like we see in other aspects of society, about 90% of the people want to do the right thing, like Tom does. There's always that 10% that, yeah, you wish you had them, but you just have to understand that's the way it plays out. And we do account for that in our population estimates. But the deer hunting harvest registration is the biggest citizen science project we have in the state. And hunters, by contributing their registration data, help inform good management decisions in the future. And most everybody is doing it, but there's a chunk of people, unfortunately, that aren't on board.
Jeff, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
You bet, Kate. Look forward to the next one.
Jeff Pritzel is Deer Program Specialist for the Department of Natural Resources. You can check out our program page, find out more about the conversations we have here on The Morning Show. Visit wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.